when you have something to bring to the table academically and you're not able to, like, I think that's the problem. And the other problem is that, you know, on the other hand of things, you have people that have nothing to bring but hatred and really don't have any good things to bring to the debate or bring to the table. And I'm thinking of, you know, like, for instance, you know, Milo Yiannopoulos or Richard Spencer go to, you know, they just say edgy things at an event and protest, you know, like, people rightly protest them. I mean, you don't see, you don't see protesters at my events, you know. You have these things, and we're trying to deplatform people who are inherently bad people that have, they're not contributing to a debate, they're really just spouting back propaganda. You know, and so there's sort of there's two sides to that coin. So it's not that, you know, there's a good kind of deplatforming and there's a bad kind of deplatforming. So, but, you know, it's honestly,
yes, you've had a chance to speak at a number of campuses.
Right, it really was just a blip, from our perspective.
I'm certainly proud of SDSU and the CSU for having a chance to host you. Thank you for agreeing to be here.
Thanks. Oh, we just did an event at MIT instead. Right.
Sure, that's So let's shift to the topic of whistleblowing. I'll try to keep the compound question down to three parts.
Okay.
So generally speaking, what are your thoughts on whistleblowing or whistleblowers? But specifically, do you think citizens in a democracy have a duty to expose the crimes committed by a government, even if it is in the course of a war? And is there an important moral difference or other kind of difference between the role of a citizen and that of a military personnel?
The answer to the citizen versus military person is that there isn't between the two, realistically. I mean, as far as I'm concerned. I don't really use the term whistleblower. It's just, I find it to be sort of a green, ethereal term. Or use. So I think that there are people who can expose that can expose things, and that I more view this as sort of like an act of, you know, direct action, a way of, as an individual, doing a thing to resist an institution and organization of authority. To sort of go outside the bounds. I mean, you know, like there's this whole notion about, well, you know, there are channels, like, I love this discussion about channels. There are channels that you can go through. It's a great rhetorical point, but there are no channels that you can go through in many situations. There are no safe channels, at least. You can go through them, but, I mean, you're not going to be safe. I mean, Jeslyn Raddick is an attorney and a friend of mine. And she's made a career out of defending federal officials who have, from criminal charges, for going through the safe channels. Like, they're actually weapons used against people. Like, if you start going through them, you end up under investigation. So it's very, you know, like, she's had to defend people, and she's often, in some instances, like Thomas Drake, she's even, like, they ruined Tom Drake, and Tom Drake went to Congress. The safe channels rhetoric is completely nonsense. But going beyond that, I view it as a form of protest, as a form of direct action, where you go outside of the system. That is the point, is to do something that is outside of the process. So, you can't depend on, you can't ask, and then, you know, there's this whole notion of, like, whenever institutions can and do fail. And when they fail, you can't ask them to be better anymore. Like, you have to go outside of that system. You have to go outside of that process. And this happens anywhere, you know, whether it's at a local level, whether it's, you know, systemic problems in our jail system, whether it's systemic problems in the military, whether it's systemic problems in the intelligence community, whether it's systemic problems at work. You know, if you're working, I don't know, there's all these problems everywhere, but you can't depend or ask these systems to fix themselves. We actually have to do stuff. And that's sort of the debate that I have with like the AI stuff is, you know, whenever we're dealing with algorithms, they're not gonna fix themselves.
So you would encourage all of us to be aware of the
case.
We all
have an ethical duty, and if we're not doing it, and you know, there's reasons why we wouldn't want to do it. But if we're not doing it and we can be doing something, I mean, we're in a sense complicit. You know, there's an ethical complicity, I think, in being not just apathetic, but you know, in being actively aware of something and then being aware that you can do something about it.
Let me circle back to this distinction between the average citizen and the citizen who becomes a member of the armed forces. You said you don't see a distinction.
I don't.
And so say a little bit more about why you don't.
Well, I mean, you know, like, it's a job. I mean, you know, we all have different jobs and different roles. I think that it's just a sense of, like, who your employer is. That seems to be the distinction that's made there. I understand the difference between, you know, sort of your more, I always have a struggle with, like, the notion of whether or not I was sort of in the military, because, like, I got the feeling like I'm a desk, you know, like I work behind a desk, and also I was in the intelligence community, which is sort of a much more ethereal, like I had to work with civilians, contractors. I mean, sometimes wasn't even uniformed, you know, it was like just the rank structure kind of gets, you know, muddled up in the intelligence community. So,
So would you call for the abolition of the military system of justice?
I mean, you know, certainly the military justice system has all, you know, there's an inherent conflict of interest when you're the employer and you're able to, you know, dole out administrative justice in the form of, you know, prison or, you know, I think that's sort of complicated, the sort of complicated relationship between, you know, in the military, because they're both, it's the only one place in which you have both your criminal justice authority and your administrative authority in terms of your job are the same person. So it's a very interesting environment. And the United States has a very different approach than the rest of the world to it. You know, a lot of European militaries move their, you know, to do something wrong military-wise, they shifted over to the civil court. I'm saying that, you know, we're kind of an outlier in having this conflict.
So we talked a little bit about national security, and you said you wanted to make sure you had a chance to talk about the concept of national security. So let me pose the question this way.
Yeah.
Can the requirements of democracy be balanced with the supposed requirements of a national security state?
Well, what does national security mean? I mean, I hear a lot of people say, oh, national security, national security, national security. But like, you know, let's look at an analysis of the term national.
All my philosophy students, please take note.
Yeah. So there's in fact a legal definition to it. You know, so the definition is anything of and relating to the national defense, typically meaning the military, the Department of Defense, or foreign relations, typically meaning the State Department and relationships between the United States and other countries. That's a pretty vague, you know, definition, and it encompasses an enormous amount of information. And that definition keeps expanding every year. I mean, you know, you just look at the number of people that get security clearances. I mean, there's Department of Education people who need, you know, secret security clearances, and they never touch anything that's really sensitive, but they're still for national, you know, they're still considered as falling under sort of the national security, you know, rubric. So it's just becoming this like broad, expansive phrase. It's used as an excuse to stifle, conversation about a particular thing. Whenever you start delving into this debate about, what national security is, I mean, it helps to just, think about about how meaningless that term has become, and how, just looking at the executive order that deals with classified information, for instance, it's like if anything, any information, any national security information that could cause X damage, could cause damage, could cause serious damage, or could cause grave damage. And those are the definitions to classify something. And again, it's just a blank check for them to classify anything because there's no real definition to these things. So everything ends up getting pooled in as being more and more. It just becomes bigger, the number of documents. Yeah, and I think this is a problem with, the apparatus that we have today. We have the largest military in the world. We have the largest prison system in the world. We have the largest incarcerated population. We have the largest intelligence apparatus. We have the largest and most expensive intelligence apparatus. We spend $600 billion a year on defense alone. And, and you hear the debates, and it's like, we need more. We need more. It's like, we already have the biggest and the most, and we still, you hear from both sides of the political conversation about more, and it's like about which kind of more, as opposed to like whether or not we should be pushing back and rolling back, many of the institutions. And I certainly, think that we could do with a whole lot less, but that's another story.
Let's focus this specifically on surveillance and surveillance technology and how that, in your opinion, affects democracy in America.
Democracy in America. Ooh, that's a subject.
You're in the talk, though, okay?
Yeah. We are all under surveillance, and not just by the government. We're also under corporate surveillance, which is this sort of privatized, surveillance that we sign up for. I mean, we sign. I mean, like, how many terms of agreement have you checked? Have you hit on a checkbox in the last year? I mean, probably a couple hundred without even really reading it. So we're turning over an enormous amount of information, and we're told about it, and we say, okay. Here's all of my personal information that you need to do this transaction. You get a date, you get some time to get a place, and we just need this huge electronic trail of everything that we do, every Starbucks purchase, every time we hit a Wi-Fi, every time you sign up for a free whatever. Chances are that if something is free, then you're probably exchanging your privacy. So we have to be more cognizant, more aware as individuals. And I understand. I work at like paranoid levels of security in terms of like how I secure my electronics. But that's not necessary for the average person. But I think that we should be more cognizant of what information we're leaving out there. I think that we should. If you're not using locational services, why do you have not? Turn it off. And they make it hard. The phone companies, they have to go through like three different menus, but I mean, it's a good practice to get into, because locational services, you're constantly beaming exactly where you are. If you don't need your cell phone on at a particular moment, turn it off. I mean, if you don't want to be giving out your personal information all the time, withhold it. Say, no, I don't want to hear. Just be more cognizant and more self-aware. It doesn't mean that you can't. I obviously turn on locational services sometimes because I get lost or I need a lift or something like that. I use these systems too, but I turn them off when